The Reserve Bank family led by the governor. I'm sure all of us, we do have an agenda in front of us. We'll be taking a presentation from the Reserve Bank on their annual report. They do not have a presentation that will be posted on the screen. They will speak direct from the report that was submitted to Parliament. And I can see from their faces that they are not the happiest people on earth, especially when the future is not clear in relation to what is happening around us. But I hope they will try and be happy as possible when they present this presentation. I will hand over to you, Governor, and you will introduce your team.
Thanks very much. Perhaps if I could introduce the team from the end up. On my right is Sheena Reynolds, our company secretary. Next to her is Nadine Ford-Hoon, who is head of our financial market, financial services, the CFO of the Reserve Bank. Next to her is Johan de Jager, our legal counsel. On my immediate left is Tlangani Matabula, who's head of strategy and communications. And on my right is Francois Groep, who is a board member, non-executive board member, independent, who chairs our risk committee, the board subcommittee on risk. And we thought that this would be a team that would help explain any of the issues in the report. The approach I'd like to take is first of all, to take you through the highlights of the annual report. I'm assuming it has been looked at and read and discussed by yourself, so I won't go into the detail, and then suggest Q&A on that. And perhaps after that, if that is acceptable to you, is to say you look at the annual report and this discussion in what context? And then perhaps take a look at what the global situation is like and what we're seeing there and the implications for South Africa as we see it, and then to take Q&A in that regard. Would that be acceptable to you? So perhaps just if we're then looking at the report. First of all, this is an annual report that we are certainly working towards examining what we do each time. We've had independent assessment of our report to see that we're looking at how open, how frank, how compliant we are with best practice, so that we evaluate what we're doing ongoing. And just to take you through, the report sets out, we've tried to make it accessible to people who are not necessarily familiar with the bank, to set out what is the purpose and function of the bank in the strategic review. We look at the board of directors, and I think just if you looked at page 7 of the report that I think people have with you, you'll see that I would like to draw attention to the fact that the update from here, because there's been a considerable change since the end of this financial year, in that we have had 4 appointments from the government. The board has changed to 15, and if you are familiar with the bank in that sense, the government appoints 8 of the 15 members of the board, and shareholders elect 7 who have knowledge in different sectors, finance, mining, labor, and so on. And therefore, a lot of terms of office, what we have done is adopt as a guide, the King III, a guide to a 9-year rule of service for non-execs. And therefore, this meant that in the last annual general meeting, 3 members had completed their 9-year service, and in December last year, another member had completed 9-year service. So that meant that 4 members would be changing because of that would have served their 9-year that were shareholder elected. And the 3 members from the government appointment, 2 of whom had to also then be reappointed, 4, all of them had to be reappointed and the change in legislation made an additional person. So that there's a significant change from the composition here. We're very comfortable with the skill set that we do have on the board. It has, among them, a significant number of chartered accountants, which is, in our view, very important for the audit committee and its work. People who have sufficient experience on risk and big corporate affairs to deal with our risk board risk committee, which is a relatively new committee. And therefore, we are 14 out of the 15 are now appointed, the last two being appointed yesterday from government. And we welcome them as well. The one missing person from the 15 is a deputy governor. There is a vacancy for a deputy governor, and that is in discussion with the presidency at the moment between the board and the president to make that appointment. So the board of directors is, and there's a profile of each, and obviously that will be updated in the next annual report. The functioning of the board is set out. It's basically, in terms of the law, a governance board, and it's not a board that delegates its authority to the executive. The executive has original authority in the law, which is a shift, so that the operational side is the responsibility of the executive, and this sets out the functioning of the board, what it can do in terms of governance, and what's expected from it. If we then look at the board committees, there are a number of key board subcommittees, and all members of the board, all non-exec members of the board, sit on one or another of the committees, some on two. The chair of audit also sits on risk, and the chair of risk sits on audit. Many organizations have risk and audit together. Our view is that there's sufficient to separate them out and sufficient work to be done, and Francois chairs our risk committee. So the audit committee obviously has a very key role in the bank. The non-executive directors committee, we have created that committee so that members of the non-executive members have an opportunity, should they so wish, to discuss issues that may affect the executive in their absence. So there is a chair of the non-execs, which in a general company, which obviously the bank isn't, you would have a lead director. So in that sense, although it's not called the lead director, the chairperson of the non-executive committee fulfills that function as a person that would have a weight among non-execs to engage on any issues they feel important. So all non-exec members are members of the non-executive directors committee. That is the body that evaluates the performance of the governor. It's an annual review, self-evaluation and evaluation by the non-exec of the performance of the governor, and a report on the functioning of the governors as a whole. The remuneration committee is also a very important committee. It sets the remuneration policy for the bank. And there's one difference is that the executive sets the remuneration for the non-execs. They don't set it for themselves, but the remuneration committee sets the remuneration for the executive and for the bank as a whole. The board risk committee we established last year, and that has is something that we regard as a very important committee given the global environment to have a cross-cutting look at risk in the bank. We then move on to the management structure, and you see the governance executive committee is the day-to-day operational responsibility of the bank. A number of the key committees, if you look to the governance coordinating committee, that is a meeting of the executive, which is the governors, and the governance executive committee with all heads of departments, so that there is a governance coordinating committee to see that there is an engagement from the executive with management in a structured way as well as on the one-to-one level. Keys Committee is Monetary Policy Committee you're familiar with, but what we've done is the bank had a Financial Stability Committee that had a more sort of general role. What we've done is elevate and change the role of the Financial Stability Committee. As you're aware, financial stability is really something that all central banks are now focusing on. And there's always been, for central banks, there's always been an implicit financial stability role. What South Africa has done is make it an explicit responsibility of the bank. So we then have a Financial Stability Committee that meets on alternate months to the Monetary Policy Committee. Its membership includes all members of the Monetary Policy Committee, but additional members as well. and it has a very different discussion. So we look at all the things that would relate to the financial stability concerns that we may have. What is then done is a brief summary and update is then presented to the Monetary Policy Committee when it meets. So we have two very important committees that have policy function. So an explicit financial stability committee that's internal to the bank. Just perhaps on that, we have, as you've seen, and it'll come a little later in the report, there's an overhaul of the regulatory environment. And one of the things around financial stability is that although there may be a designation that financial stability is best housed at the Reserve Bank, financial stability is a country issue. It's not an institutional issue. And therefore, in terms of what we'd be looking to put into legislation, what we have operational at this point in time, is a Financial Stability Oversight Committee, in which we meet. It's co-chaired by the Minister of Finance and the Governor of the Reserve Bank, and it has representation on it from the Reserve Bank, from the National Treasury, and from the Financial Services Board. And therefore, that would meet on a regular basis, as and when required, but estimated at least quarterly, but it can meet daily if required, to look at what is happening, what we're all seeing, what is happening in the markets. Are there anything that we should be seeing? Because resolution of crisis is a country issue, not an institutional issue, although institutions all play a role within that. So we then have a management committee, which is your heads of departments, chaired by a deputy governor, which looks at the ongoing work within the bank. We have a very well-defined approach to budgeting, and therefore a budget committee that examines all budgets in between, and each department has to present. That would be ongoing and very tightly managed. It also has to get approval with the presentation by each and every head of department, no substitutes allowed, to the GEC, the Executive Committee. And from that, it is then taken as the budget of the bank, both the operational budget, the personnel budget, and the capital budget is taken to the board. So the board approves the budgets that we have and examines them in detail. We also have an internal risk committee, a risk management committee, which takes a cross-section of all the risks across the bank and discusses that internally. Obviously, that also supports the board risk committee in its information. And another important committee would be the Reserve Management Committee, which has a number of people on that who are responsible for managing the $50-odd billion that we are responsible for. In that committee, you would have also representation from the National Treasury. So Reserve Management is a co-responsibility between us, although it's housed and dealt with primarily through the Reserve Bank. We then move on to the report on monetary policy, which covers from page 25 to 29. And in essence, this gives you a review of the monetary policy actions and reports that we have taken in the past year. So it is really just a record of monetary policy actions over the year under review. We would then look at the operational review. And that tries to give you more information of what lies behind what we actually do. And I'm not going to go through it in detail, but it does look at how we're looking at exchange controls, what our role is, or accumulation of reserves, our responsibility towards the banking system and sound banking. The approach we're taking to regulatory reform is covered in it. The approach to financial stability is spelled out a little bit further. The role in relation to the payment system by the South African Reserve Bank, the question of currency supply and distribution, the research, which is a very important part, a very significant part of the bank. Central banks' research departments are probably around 50% of what you do, because it is your data, it is your analysis, it is your reporting, and it is the vehicle through which the country as a whole, as well as your international obligations, look at what is happening in your country and your reporting standards and who you have to report to. A very important part of what we do as well is regional cooperation. The Reserve Bank is, obviously we have regular meetings of the CMA, as well of the Committee of Central Bank Governors of SADC. There are 15 countries, one not allowed to act there at the moment, which is Madagascar. But that meets regularly to look at convergence on the economic numbers. So we're trying to look at what would make the regional the region coherent. How does what underpins? So the payment system would be part of what we do in SADC, in the CCBG. Looking at primarily, it's about how do we get convergence about our economic outlook. So what are our goals for inflation? What is our goal for growth? How do we try to get common appearance so that the ability to interact and trade is made easier by the infrastructure that it supports and by a common approach? Those meetings are held on a regular basis, and South Africa chairs that body. We have an outreach program in which we are engaging with a wide variety of South African stakeholders to try to convey what the bank does, what we can't do, but certainly what we can do. So we meet with a range of organizations, institutions, sectors in the economy to discuss. And secondly, for us to learn and ensure that we are in touch with the real issues, so that part of it would be if we're dealing with, say, the manufacturing sector or the agricultural sector or the motor industry, to actually have people go out to the factory, see what's happening, have the discussions on site. So that's part of what we do, and we're also looking at how to strengthen that engagement so that we get a much wider interaction with CEOs and what their plans are, what they're doing. So that's a very big part of what we're looking at. And then obviously the whole question of the norms around business continuity and so on. In terms of controls, we're very focused on the strength of our internal controls, because we have a clean audit and are very sort of committed to maintaining that. And therefore, internal financial controls and the role of internal audit is very strong. Internal audit, the internal auditor and internal audit department report directly to the governor and have obviously a direct link into the internal audit, the audit committee of the bank. They have a direct link to that, and therefore it is a very strong independent function in many ways in the bank. We also have a code of ethics and business conduct that we have in the bank, and we're working on a development of value systems, which we would be evaluating on an annual basis, that is rolled out into the bank. We also have things like whistleblowing, independently done, and so on. If we looked at, we certainly take our responsibilities about legal and regulatory requirements very seriously, and we feel that we are pretty compliant in that. Risk management is something that is, again, like internal audit, a very strong feature of what we're looking at in the bank, and we have set out the, on page 41, you can see the kind of philosophy and approach to risk management that we follow. And we have created, it's a new department in the bank, we've created a risk management and compliance division department, which takes responsibility for this across the bank and the group as a whole. If you looked at page 43 onwards till page 49, really speaking, is that it deals with the human resource, and again, a focus on one-hour numbers. We employ with contractors 2,200 people, roughly, in total. We look at, we've got a very low turnover in the bank of staff, you know, so that even if you looked at it and you said, at the moment, I think this was 4-point-something this year, if I remember, 4.6 was the turnover of staff. And if you looked at the numbers in total of the 96, you'd find probably 30 of that would be through normal retirement or death or something of that nature. So the actual turnover of staff is very low. We do have an approach to ensuring that we constantly reskill and introduce new skill. We have a cadet program, which takes roughly 15 people a year, who come into departments at the sort of middle or lower level. Those are top graduates from around the country. They do a year's program with us, and provided that the department, they circulate within the department, they also have an academic qualification that they've got to attain. provided they get sufficient grades in the academic side, which is above 70%, and the department finds that they are productive and are keen, then we employ them. So on average, we do employ most of the cadets, and they then obviously strengthen the organization. You grow your own timber in that way. And that's a big part of what we do, other than, and I'll come back to the support level. We have a bursary scheme for about 20, 24 people per annum to take them all the way through. We also have a full program which costs us about 9 million rand a year, that any employee of the bank, their children who are in post-schooling, so any postgraduate study, are funded by the bank for anything they want to study. It does not have a determination. If you're an employee of the bank and you want to study further, we have our bursary program, we would indicate what we would like to study. But if you are the dependent of an employee, we do not determine what you can study, but we support all the children. Doesn't matter how many children you've got, and it doesn't matter what you study, that we pay for that for as long as you pass. So we have a program that's I think is very, it's very meaningful to staff, that they know that their university will postgraduate education of whatever kind. So we do have staff members who have four or five children and they're studying medicine, which is 6 or 7 years, and we pay for that for all of them. So it's a very big program and something that I think has been hugely beneficial. You want to work in the bank? We've set out here our corporate social responsibility, but what I would say is that we have really taken a fresh look at this completely. We've developed a policy on CSI that focuses on a much more community engagement in terms of what we can do, staff matching and so on. So that is a revised policy that we're beginning to roll out now, and therefore this would be quite relatively different going forward, and a very big part of what we are doing. So I think a much more focused approach to our CSI going forward. We then just give you a brief overview of the subsidiaries and then move on to the financials. And I would think on the financials it would be probably something that you would want to ask questions of rather than me going through the financials per se, because I think you may have specific questions. So that in essence is the content of our report. We've tried to be as open and as forthcoming as is reasonable within the space and making it interesting. And I would welcome any questions that you may have. I don't know if any of my colleagues would like to add something.
Thank you, Governor, for your brief and informative presentation. I will now allow the members to interact with the presentation. If you have any clarity, questions, or comments on the report. Van Rooyen, Honorable Dubazana, and Honorable Adams.
So thank you very much, Honourable Chair. My word of appreciation to the Reserve Bank under the leadership of Governor Marcus for the good work that has been done hitherto. I've got only two issues. My third one is just to check on one thing. You know, the fluctuations that are currently happening in the global economy are very rapid, and that necessitate the relevance of accurate or maybe appropriate estimates in terms of our economic indicators. I've never done an analysis to check how we have been, or maybe the Reserve Bank have been, obviously, performing in as far as forecasting is concerned on year-to-year basis. I'd like to get the take of the Reserve Bank team under the leadership of the governor. How are we doing as far as that is concerned? Our projections, are they almost accurate, or are we deviating that much, or what are the developments around that system? Because as we all know, I mean, as to how we project is also important for economic activities taking place in our country. Chair, on issues of loans and advances, more especially on the issue of the land bank bills, which are said to have been pledged as collateral against the foreign loans. Now, as correctly cited here, the bank does not have any ability to sell or replenish these land bank bills because they are not yet transferred to the bank. I'm not sure if this has any implication on the day-to-day operations or maybe on the mandate of the bank. Secondly, and lastly, Chair, it's apparent that there are no settlement terms that have been maybe crafted or agreed upon in respect of the IMF fund balances administered on behalf of the government. Now, I just wanted to check, is this a good practice, but also how is it impacting, if there are any implications, if it's not a good practice? You know. Thank you.
Sorry, can you just give me the reference when you're talking about the IMF balances?
It's on amounts due by the government, by the South African government. That is on page 84 of our report.
Page 84, note 9. Okay, should I take those questions first? Deal with them? Why not? If that's okay with you. Okay, I've got that. Perhaps on the first one, about the accuracy of predictions and forecasting. Our main forecasting is in relation to where we think inflation is going, and that we spell out each monetary policy meeting. We set out, this is what we are seeing, this is what we expect. So far, since over the last period, almost 2 years now, we have been within the inflation target. And as we say, that as we've indicated, we expect to be slightly outside the target towards the end of this year, early parts of next year, but that it would come back into the target. So until it happens, we're not quite sure that that would be an accurate forecast, in a sense that that's what we're forecasting, but will it materialize in that way? And partly why is that we take what is known and we try to make assumptions around that. So far, and what we are introducing going forward is a regular evaluation over the forecasts and how accurate we were, and if we deviated, what was the deviation and what was the cause of that. So we will be doing that on a regular basis going forward. But at this point in time, in the sense is that it's your best forecast that you can have, because the one thing the central bank is always dealing with is uncertainty. Right? We don't know. And in the current, so you're making assumptions on what you can anticipate. It's your best understanding of the data available. And you're trying to look forward, because in this kind of climate, when you can't use previous data or information to predict the future, because it is so different around what is happening. So if there isn't a situation where you've had a very steady kind of state about growth and about the world environments and trade and everything, it's very volatile. So it is a huge challenge, but so far we feel that we use forecasting as information. We are not wedded to a model's result. Our view is that a model is a tool to help you, but it is not an absolute. So that whatever the model says, we still interrogate that, and we still say, is that rational? What does it do? How would you see that? So generally speaking, I think that we have our ability to say we've been accurate in our forecast is, have we actually achieved the target that we want and stayed within the band, or been able to say this is what we're seeing coming out and coming back? So it's not an absolute, but certainly it is something that we are undertaking going forward, a regular review. of that. For our own sense of how reliable and how much weight you can put on, and has our judgment been right? Because we need to find a way of evaluating that. So that would be the one. But we certainly have a suite of models. It's certainly discussed. We look at all the variations that are there, and we've got a very strong team on that. But, you know, it's constantly evolving, and you're now trying to look at more difficult questions, because if you're looking at monetary policy, and the question is, how do you factor in something like financial stability? It's a very complex question of what that would mean in a modeling sense. So it's a big challenge, but something that we certainly see as a tool and an effective tool, but one that we interrogate. We don't just say the model says and therefore you do. Okay. On the second question, on the land bank bills, as far as I understand, don't affect anything at this point in time. They are collateral with us, if I'm correct, yes, around the loan that we have to Zimbabwe. So it is a Zimbabwe lodging with us land bank bills because of the loan that we have to them. It's not realized, and we certainly are over. We have more collateral than the value of the loan. So, and the loan has been regularly serviced. We haven't had a problem. I don't know if there's anything in addition to that, Johan.
Our Act actually requires us, if we make loans, that they have to be secured. So this was secured, so they're there. They're a security, but the counterparty has service the loan all the time, so they still there.
And they're very specific things. I mean, we can't just take anything as collateral. It has to be certain types of assets that are collateral. And then in terms of the fund balance, Nadine, do you want to just address that?
Those balances have been there a very long time, and those are the terms and conditions that we are aware of. And I don't think it's anything out of the ordinary. That they don't have any settlement terms.
It's the standard practice. It's a country issue. So it wouldn't be a problem if that there's no settlement term. Okay. You want to follow up?
Yes. No, in fact, from my layman's understanding, I thought any loan that we, or any transaction that we get into with IMF, there must be settlement terms. It can't just be an arrangement without terms. So that's why I'm asking if is this a best practice or what?
Yeah. Let's say it out loud.
I'm just a legal person, so I'm talking under correction here, but what happens is, and this is why it's been in the books for a long time, if you remember as a country of the IMF, of a central bank, there's an account that's opened in your name, and this is actually what is maintained here. So it's an account, and it continues. It's like an overdraft or something, an account that's open for you all the time with them, and this is the account that's been there. So there are no settlement terms. If in future it is necessary for us to actually fall back on the IMF, this is the account that's actually going to be used. So it's not something that you're going to square off. I think if I can draw an analogy, it's like a membership fee that you really have with them there, with the IMF in this account.
Maybe I thought you'd make a reference to a certain facility of IMF, so if one can make a follow-up.
We have no facilities. We have no facilities with the IMF. Okay. No, no problem. Thank you. You are now satisfied, Honourable Member. Because if you are not, we can call SARB again to come and explain this. But if not, we can send you something in writing as well, so that we can just go into the origin of this and send you something in writing. We're more than happy to do that. No problem. Honourable, thank you, Chair.
First, I would like to thank the Reserve Bank family led by Comrade Jill Marcus. Thank you for the comprehensive report that you've just summarized and put into perspective. And also thank the bank for, because like you have said, you know, financial stability management is a very complex and a diverse, complicated matter. For taking a decision that rather let us do the explicitity of the task so that we are able to manage it. But having said that, I would love to understand when is the bank going to start determined the exact nature of the oversight, what as far as those became the, because remember you have just indicated to us that you have expedited it into two committees. So now, but I'm not too sure when are you going to say to us as the committee, this is the oversight that we'll be actually doing, so that at the end of the day we also follow and say you are within what you have said you were going to do. I would appreciate if I can get the time on that. And my questions then, Honourable Chairperson, would be on the subsidiaries of the bank, your companies. You know, I'm a bit worried about the other three companies. That is the SABN, the Mint, and the other one for the what insurances. Yeah.
So
yeah, because those companies are operating under the Companies Act. And you find the way when you look at page 100 of your report, which is their financials. They spend so much on the rent. There's so much that they spend on the rent, especially the which one is this? We call it the South African Reserve Bank Captive Insurance Company. They've spent about 2.2 rent. You know, this Liz problem, it is a problem. It is a problem to us as legislators as to why can't we just build our own buildings and because in the long term, then we'll save a lot of money than to spend so much. Governor, there's 30.2 there, where amounts to buy and to the subsidiaries. You know, the banknotes, I just want to know the value of banknotes in circulation to the state. Because if I look at it, according to the report, it is indicating that it is lower than the nominal GDP growth. Now, does this mean that we have not yet recovered to that 200 notes, which happened in February 2005? If up to date, and if that's the case, then what is the bank doing? Because it actually worries. And when this company, the bank note company, had a loss of 23. 0.88, then we decided to give them the loan of 32.2. What was that loan for? Why was it? What it was allocated for? What specific activity? I need the clarity as far as the cooperation of the public deposits on call deposits. Because to me, if I do understand, that's the loss of about three. Is that a loss, or is it? I can see your CFO nodding the head. But if anything that in brackets to me, it says it's a loss. I'm sure I'm going to get the clarity on that one once the chair gives you the opportunity to respond. There was an issue, Honourable Chair, that the bank outsourced the printing at the mint, I don't know whether it was the printing of a money, to the European. Is it still on? That European company is still doing our job. Is the problem still about the equipment? When are you going to start resolving it? When are you going to return the funds back home so that we create jobs?
Why don't we try and answer that? And then maybe give you a second bite.
Is it? Okay, Honourable Chair, can I just continue to finish up so that it's 1 day. Okay. So, mustn't worry. It's 1 question. It's a very good thing that you're supporting the children of your staff. It's a very good thing. It's one of the retention strategies. I really appreciate it. But having said that, I will really appreciate it if it shows in your financial because now I don't know whether it does it belong under the to the liabilities, whether it's a good thing that you're doing, where is it showing, if I can be assisted in that. Thank you. So that I'm able to see as to how much the bank has spent thus far and to whom, by the way. Thanks, Governor.
Okay. Perhaps if we give the Reserve Bank an opportunity to respond, then we'll come back to your questions, Madam.
Perhaps just on the last point about where we spend, it is in our report as to the amount under education, I mean under HR. It would be on page 48 where we spell out how that works and what the positions are. It is educational support for dependents on staff, which gives you the amount and what is happening. Yeah. So it's 6.6 million in the previous review period, and in this one was 9 million in this period, and it affected 393 dependents. So we were supporting 393 dependents in there. And obviously they graduate and they go on and so on. So perhaps at that we have set out there. And it is something depending on what the staff take-up is, the age of the kids, what's happening and so on. So it does, you know, it will vary from year to year as to what the amount is because it depends who's applying for what. But all staff apply on an annual basis and they know once their child is in a program, so if they're studying a BSc or CA or whatever they're studying, they know that that is renewable until they complete. The only question comes in is if they do not complete or they do not complete their studies, and then obviously then it's something that we say that's not good enough. So on that one. Perhaps on the other, and I would like to just perhaps put this question into some context. I would want to say at the outset that discussion on how and where the notes are produced is not something that should be part of a public campaign and awareness. I think it is one of the most secure facilities in the country and it should be respected as such. So where we produce notes and how we do it and what happens, I would really want us to limit the discussion without in any way limiting your role and so on. But there is a point beyond which I wouldn't want to go. Okay? And if you can accept that, because I think that is a common practice in the world that you just do not go into details of where and how. But in terms of what I would be happy to discuss, first of all, note and coin in circulation continues to grow even though we are, you know, it obviously depends on how your economic growth is taking place as to how much cash is used. We're still very much a cash economy to a large degree. The one area of transaction that is declining very, very rapidly is checks. There's almost very little use of checks, but credit cards are common, electronic payments is common, and cash is king still. Our growth in cash at the moment is about 8%, if I recall, per annum. It's around that amount, which means that there's a constantly growing demand for cash. We're also finding that there's an increased demand outside our borders. So it's not just the CMA countries that are using the South African rand. You can find the rand in Angola, in Tanzania, in Kenya, in lots of countries where it is, and in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has done away with their own currency completely, and they now use the rand or the dollar as their currency. There's no formal arrangement with us about that. You know, unlike the CMA countries where there's a formal arrangement between us about the rand, although they will all have their own currencies, there's a formal arrangement around the rand and an agreement about repatriation and sinnerage and everything else. With Zimbabwe, they have simply decided not to have their own currency and to use the rand and the US dollar as currency. So we're finding that there's a lot of demand for currency for the rand, including 5 rand coins, which are going into Zimbabwe. Obviously, we get something that comes back and repatriation, but there is a big demand there. So we have in circulation about 75 billion rand is there, and it's growing at an 8% on average at this point in time. If you looked a few years back, you would see it was growing at about 12 or 13% when the economy was much more vibrant than it is at the moment. Do we have problems around the currency of 200? No. I don't think so. That has been taken out of circulation, which is the pre-2005 200 rand note, and it is now just the normal 200 rand note that is in use. and would continue to be there. Obviously, there's certain demand for different denominations, and it's something that we feel we could manage better than we do at the moment, which we will do going forward as we're planning with the commercial banks. But an important part of this in terms of production is that production is taking place at the bank, note company. There have been no layoffs. The issues that we identified last year, it's not a simple thing of saying, you know, have you addressed it and is it done? It's an ongoing process of addressing it and the problems, because it is something that we're quite confident and comfortable with the notes in circulation. But it is something that we have had to deal with. And as you're aware, the consequence was that, or what we felt, what we found was such that it resulted in our having an independent hearing over the, with the MD, the former MD. And that independent hearing found him guilty of the charges, and we dismissed him. So we have acted in relation to that. We have tightened the relationships so that although they are wholly owned subsidiaries, we have looked at a better approach to the group so that both with Banknote Company and the Mint, the policies around HR, IT, the other measures that you would have, we want that to be a group approach. So we don't want an HR policy in a subsidiary that's different from an HR policy in the bank, and so on. So that's what we're working on at the moment. We have a new chair of the Banknote Company, which is Ms. Kusum Kalyan. She's a long-standing board member there and has a very good feel for it, and we've got a new MD. So those steps have been taken to as part of the addressing of the issues that we found there. So we think we've taken the necessary measures, and production is taking place, and we're quite comfortable with that. And, you know, I don't want to go into usage of where and what and how, if you don't mind, but we are committed to ensuring that the Banknote Company is equipped and has the adequate staff and the program. Don't forget, we are the only clients. They did engage in the past in a couple of other clients, but going forward, we are the only clients for the foreseeable future, which means that their profitability, your point about the profitability, it depends on what we order from them, right? So our orders, if you looked at our financials, our orders on currency were much lower. So that the amount of revenue, they've got obviously a standing overhead, which then was affected by the fact that there was a lower order from the Banknote Company, not from the Mint. But we're quite comfortable that going forward, we're quite determined, let me not say comfortable, determined going forward, that the Banknote Company should be fully functional as the professional entity that it needs to be. And obviously that will also entail some added equipping, because some of its equipment is pretty old. And technology has changed so rapidly, and there's so many ways in which you can improve that. So that is part of the program going forward. So in terms of your question around jobs and so on, there's no prospect of the Banknote Company not fulfilling that role as it has. In fact, upgrading and upskilling, and probably if we get this working over the time, don't forget this is something that does take a few years to really develop properly. The Mint functions, I think, extremely well, and I hope most of you have been to the Mint, because you can go to the coin shop there, and it really is a very wonderful thing. We're very skilled in our numismatic coins. We win internationally the design prizes most of the time, or many times for that, and we're very well known for our numismatic coins and the program that we have there. They're very highly sought after. So if any of you are on the way to Pretoria, able to go in, I'm sure you'll have a treat to go there. But we think that the Mint is running well. But again, aging equipment, things that have not been modernized, so there's going to be some expenditure in that regard. Simran, sure.
Can I just deal with the issue around the 200 note? Because this question keeps on popping in the media all over the show around whether we ever had a problem with the 200 note. There was never a problem with the 200 note. We withdrew the old series 200, which predated 2005, because in 2005 we upgraded the security features on the 200 note. Now, we had reached a stage where, as a bank, we felt that the old series 200 note that were in circulation were very small, and we needed to take them out completely so that the ones with the upgraded features could be the ones in circulation. It was not an issue of counterfeit. It was not an issue that there was ever a problem with the 200 and note. It was a deliberate action on the part of the Reserve Bank to take out notes that did not have the new upgraded feature. As you will appreciate, all over the world, there are certain time frames within which banks upgrade the security features on their notes, and we do so to comply with international security standards, and all our notes are compliant. Now, this statement must not be read to say that there will not be chance takers who will try to counterfeit our notes. Invariably, you will find that if those people do try that, they get caught up very quickly, and it normally is a police matter, and the police acts very swiftly on those cases where people try to counterfeit our notes, because the security features are quite strong and very difficult to replicate.
Just a couple of things that I wanted to add, if I may, Madam Chair, is that on your question of rental, we own the properties. So it's not like you are renting from someone else. Both the bank, where the banknote is and where the mint is, that's wholly owned by those entities, as far as I know. But perhaps just add to that, Nadine.
I think it's important to note, under this particular note, all of it is intercompany transactions, so it's all within the Saab group. The $32 million was a loan to erect the Pretoria North branch on the property of the SA banknote. So it's one of our one of the bank's branches. So we gave a loan to the banknote to erect the Pretoria North branch. And effectively what happens is you'll see under City Point 3, we receive interest, we charge interest at the repo on that particular loan, and the rent paid that you're referring to is actually the Pretoria North branch paying rent to the South African banknote company. So they're all intergroup transactions. And effectively, the way it was structured was that when you look at what we pay in terms, what we receive in terms of interest on that loan from the banknote company and what Pretoria North branch are paying in terms of rental, they more or less offset each other. Yes, it's just an intergroup transaction. So it's not going to any external party, it's within the group.
And all the property is owned by the bank or members of its group, the banknote company or the mint. So we own all the property where we have branches as well.
Honourable Adam. Thank you, Chair. Mine is on human resources. The government said that Saab has a low staff turnover. How do you intend to implement the bank's equity employment plan by 2014 if there's a low staff turnover? And then the South African Reserve Bank College has a staff establishment of 21, but 50% of them are on contract. Are you going to employ them, and how do you intend to place them? Thank you.
Should I tie with that? Okay, let's start with the Saab College. It has a very small staff. Where they are on contract, it is often people who have retired from the bank that we, because of their knowledge, that we don't want to just lose, so we put them on contract maybe 2 days a week or whatever. So we don't intend to employ them, because they are staff who have reached retirement age and want to put back into the system. So they're on contract with us for a period of time and different periods to put back their knowledge. So if, for instance, if I gave you a concrete example, the head of financial markets reached 60 and retired in April this year, but he doesn't want to, he feels he's got so much knowledge, so part of the training program he now does, so he has a contract with us, but we're not re-employing him. Okay, so they do have staff that are employed as part of the college, and we're looking to see how that, I mean, we do a lot of training for central banks in the continent and our own staff. That's really the focus of it. We're looking to expand that training to see whether we can't do things where people are, for instance, to create a wider understanding of what central banking is about, where people are doing economics degrees or studying further, so that we can use the college for that as well. So that's really the general question around the contracts. There may be some other specifics, but most of it is where we're asking people who have retired, who are willing to put back their time and their knowledge into the next generation. Would be the first question. Your first question was around our employment equity. In essence, if you looked at our the low turnover is something that we feel is not necessarily a problem for the following reasons. First of all, we actually have made a very strong strides in employment equity in the bank. If you look at it, our numbers actually are reasonably good. There's certainly room for improvement. But part of it is we've got a very changing situation. If you take, say, for instance, the regulatory reform that is part of bringing all prudential, as was agreed by Cabinet, and that we're working on at the moment, bringing all prudential into the bank, we're going to get a huge influx of new staff. So until we know exactly what our staff is going to look like and what it does, we're not quite sure what it will do to our numbers, because we don't know who's coming in and what numbers are coming in. But it's estimated anything 50, 60, 70 people who will be coming in for that function alone. The second question is that in certain areas we are having to expand staff. So that, again, in the regulatory side, and I'm using the regulatory as an example, if you took bank supervision, you've got a whole lot of areas that relate to the Basel III implementation, new demands on what needs to be done, and we're going to have to expand staff in that regard. We've also created, as I said, a new department, risk and compliance, which is recruiting staff. So within all of those areas, we feel we'll be able to address the employment equity demand. We don't see this as a problem. We actually are reasonably confident. If we look at the CVs that we get and the applications that we're getting, it really has a very, just in terms of the quality of people coming through, we're seeing that it really is addressing it in itself. So although we have a very clear policy around it as well, especially on gender as well as race, we're seeing that coming through in the applications for people to come in. So we are, because we're expanding our staff over real areas of growth, the low turnover is not necessarily an inhibition at this point in time. And we are looking at all levels, so it's not something that says only this is only at entry level. But we are seeing that the demographics are going reasonably well in our view. I don't know if anyone wants to add to that. But we're finding in all areas, is because of the demand and the growth of the demand and what the central bank is doing, and I'm sure you're aware of that, central bank demand is just exponentially growing. We are finding we have to increase staff. So the low turnover is not an inhibitor to attaining the goal. Nadine?
I'm not going to be adding on this, but Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to one of the other questions where one of the members raised the CPD and the brackets and the loss issues. I'd like to address that if I can. That is not a loss. Brackets don't always mean loss. In this situation, it means it's a liability in the bank's book. Effectively, what happens there is the CPD, Corporation for Public Deposits, they have placed on call with the SARB deposits, and therefore it's a liability in the SARB's books because we are owing it back to the CPD. And so it's not a loss. It's just reflecting the balance that is with the SARB at that point in time.
Perhaps Nadine just deal with the transfer to government as well.
Yes, and the CPD, in fact, if you look at their financials were tabled in Parliament on the 31st of August, they actually made a profit of $53.1 million. And so effectively how the CPD works, it receives funds or monies from potential or from depositors. It then takes those deposits and it goes and invests those funds in various money market instruments. And one of the areas that they would invest in is with the SARB on call. And this is what is reflected, because this is basically an intercompany transaction. It's reflected because the CPD is a subsidiary, a wholly owned subsidiary of the SARB. So in our books, it's reflected as a liability, and in this situation, that's why we've reflected the brackets, just to distinguish between what an asset is and what a liability is. At the end of every year, whatever's left in the CPD is transferred after paying a dividend to the Saab of 200,000, that is transferred basically to government as surplus. Okay, I'm done. I'll take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No. Why? Why I was confused, Madam Chair, is because the CPD it's somehow, if you compare with the other three, you are more babysitting it. It's within even the infrastructure, the accounting system. You're doing everything for it. Now, looking at that three as a liability from the coal deposits, it was confusing me as to why it didn't go to the group.
On consolidation in the group figure, we need to take out all intercompany transactions, and this is an intercompany transaction between the bank and group. In bank, you'll always see it reflected in the bank's liability column, but when we consolidate the group from an accounting perspective, we need to eliminate intercompany transactions. But effectively, it's the CPD's deposit that is lying in the bank's books.
No, not necessarily a follow-up. It might be something outside the scope of the annual report. Just recently, there is a scare that is going around in the public domain that we might experience a credit bubble. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe in your analysis you might have picked this up domestically. So but I would like to just to get some indication if it's something that we need to be worried of as a committee, but also globally, I mean, the meltdown on the financial system, what are the strategic lessons going forward that we maybe must know about as a committee, you know?
Sure. Can I just ask guidance? Because obviously that would take us into the second part of what we wanted to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if one would, if there are any more questions on the annual report.
Yes.
If there are, then one could deal with this and then come to that. But I need your guidance on that.
Thank you. In fact, I was going to request members that let's follow the approach as we agreed at the beginning of this meeting. We're still coming to those issues as it was outlined earlier on. Are there any more questions on this part of the presentation? Nothing. We can go ahead.
Thanks very much, and I'll ask my colleagues to add from their perspectives. Look, I think that the points you're making are extremely important, and maybe just at the outset to say that in terms of South Africa, and I'm just trying to see where I've put all my pieces of paper. Yeah. In terms of South African credit bubble, no, we're not seeing that at all. If you looked at private sector credit extension, it is very low. It is around 6%. Some of that is low. You can see the credit extended on mortgages is low. Some of that is going to the commercial and corporates, which is fine. But at 6%, it is a very low private sector credit extension. So we are not concerned about a credit bubble at this point in time. If anything, I think the question is there demand for credit and is there supply of credit? And that is a huge challenge for South Africa because we are not seeing credit extension taking root in a way that would we're not looking for, certainly we don't want to go to a bubble, but you know, if you looked at some other countries their challenges is it's about 35% in some countries or in the early 30s, so they would have a problem, but we're at 6% and it's rising slightly but very slowly. So I don't see that as a problem for South Africa at this point in time. But let me first start with the global issues, and I don't know if anyone had the opportunity to hear what Jean-Claude Trichet said yesterday. Jean-Claude Trichet is the governor of the European Central Bank, and you know, central bankers are by nature extremely conservative, and they use their words in a very measured manner. So that if you had to look at the statements, whether there's a word in or out, it usually has great significance. And yesterday he said, which is very outspoken for him, that over the past 3 weeks, the situation has continued to be very demanding. The crisis is systemic and must be tackled decisively. The high interconnectedness in the European financial system has led to a rapidly rising risk of significant contagion. It threatens financial stability in the EU as a whole and adversely impacts the real economy in Europe and beyond. He called for governments and European authorities to act together to solve the crisis, adding that delay would be disastrous. It is a matter of urgency that all authorities act in unison with total commitment to safeguard the financial stability. I think that is an unbelievably strong statement from a central bank head and reflects just how grave the situation is. In reality, if you looked at it, there's a coming together of three elements of a crisis. First of all, it's synchronized. There's a synchronized downturn in the advanced economies. That is the United States, Europe, UK, and Japan. And perhaps if you just had to look at some of the new growth forecasts that they've given for those countries as projected for, and I'll just use some of the advanced economies in terms of growth and outlook. If you look at it for the G3 economies, the expected growth for the second quarter of this year is 0.6. If you looked at the United States, its last quarter was 0.4. They're expecting 1.3 or lower. Japan is minus 2. The euro area as a whole is 0.6. Germany, which is the strong man of Europe, is at 0.5. France is at 0. United Kingdom at 0.4. Greece at minus 7. Portugal minus 0.2. Spain at 0.6. If you're looking at growth quarter on quarter, this is telling you that Europe is in huge trouble, huge trouble. If you then had to look at it and add to it, what is its fiscal deficit? If you look at the United States, for the projection 2010 in the United States fiscal deficit was 10.3, in 2009 was 12.8, and the expectations for this year is 9.6. That's the United States. Projections for next year 7.9. Now, look at that as your growth at that kind of level. This is your deficit. And then you look at general government gross debt, that's debt-GDP ratios for these countries. United States projections for this year is 100%, and next year at 105. That is its debt-GDP ratio. Debt is a percentage of GDP. Euro area this year is expected to be 88.6 and to go to 90%. France is at 90%. Italy at 121%. Japan at 233%. And then you go to emerging markets. Emerging markets are a pretty different picture. If you look at China projections for its deficit for this year is 1.6. And its debt-GDP ratio is expected to be at 27%. India projection for this year is 8% in the deficit, and its debt-GDP at 64%. Russia, 1.1% deficit. So if we take South Africa, we are at, we expect at the moment about 5.5%. We'll see what it comes out at the medium-term budget policy statement. But our debt-GDP ratio is expected to peak at 43% or around there. At the moment, the expectation for 2011 is still under 40%. So very different scenarios for the emerging markets as for the advanced economies, and equally in relation to growth. Because if you looked at some of the growth numbers, they're looking at what is a hard landing for China, and that's at probably 6%. 6% is tough for China, but let us have 6% growth, we'd be quite happy. So you're seeing growth falling, and one of the distinctions, what you're seeing in the Eurozone, in the United States, in the advanced economies, is a commitment or a statement about lower interest rates for longer, and that is a statement about the state of the economy in those countries. And what you're seeing in emerging markets is lower growth, but rising inflation. So a different challenge altogether in emerging markets, slower growth, rising inflation. And obviously that will depend on what happens to commodity prices, and that will depend what happens on growth in the advanced economies. So in essence, there are three crises coming together. That is a growth and unemployment crisis, a sovereign debt crisis, and a banking crisis. Because if you don't deal with your sovereign debt, the way it will transmit is basically through the banking system. And one of the challenges that you have in relation to that is that I just want to see these. Okay. Part of what you're seeing, if you look to this, is if we take that, what we're seeing in the overall, it is your slow growth in the advanced economies, your sovereign debt crisis, and your banking sector concerns, which are mainly Europe. The essence of it is that your sovereign debt and your banking crisis is what is influencing significantly growth on the downside. GDP growth is slowing worldwide with downward revisions all the time. So they think it's this, and each time it comes out lower. And there is talk of recession and possibilities of recession. Some of the countries in Europe are already in recession. But it is a challenge as to whether there is a recession. What the approach that we see in the SARP is that it's not just whether you have a recession or you don't. The current conditions are so severe that if this continues as it is, you still have an enormously difficult situation. So going into recession would make it worse. But even as it stands, if it continues at this level, you have a huge challenge to come out of this. We are now entering our fifth year of this global crisis. It started in 2007. And if you look at the severity of the moment, there's many more years to come before we're out of this. So the challenge is going to be, to what degree do you have a generational question of unemployment or low growth, and what happens in those circumstances? The key supply inputs, which is oil, food, are higher than in 2009 and 10 and are dragging on growth. And there's a downside risk to commodity prices if there's a significant slowdown in growth. In essence, from the advanced economies, there's a lower outlook, inflation outlook for the advanced economies, slower global growth, higher inflation in the emerging markets, as I said, and very limited policy space. Interest rates are likely to remain low for even longer, especially in Europe. The banking system in Europe is under stress, and it poses a strong downside risk to the global economy. A recent move suggests a more coordinated response by governments and the ECB that it could be achieved. If we wanted to just take one factor, which I think is extremely important, which are contributing to lower growth, is the question of, there's high levels of uncertainty that are constraining investment. If corporates do not have the ability to know there's growth and there will be development taking place, they don't invest. So U.S. corporates are very cash flush. They could invest, they could be drawn into it, but they are not necessarily at this point in time. And what you're seeing is that households, governments, and banks are all deleveraging at the same time. So everybody's doing this at the same time, which got to impact on growth. You're seeing high commodity prices, and therefore long-term structural issues in the advanced economy. And at a global level, these imbalances remain. You've got very high exposure of European banks, especially the German and the French, to peripheral sovereign debt. IMF estimates of that exposure by these European banks is as high as 10% of Europe's GDP. So a 40% higher haircut on Greek or Irish or Portuguese debt would result in losses estimated between almost 200 billion and 400 billion, which is an estimate of 11% of bank's capital. It is huge. If Spain is included, the minimum rises to 1.1 trillion euros, or 62% of bank's capital. So a very serious situation facing the European central banks, European banking system. What you're also seeing, which feeds into this problem, is U.S. funds have cut their European bank holdings to the lowest level in at least 5 years. So where before they were investing in European banks, they are pulling back. The 10 biggest U.S. funds, with a combined holding of $676 billion, reduced European banking assets to 42% of holdings, the lowest level since at least 2006. And U.S. funds reduced the holding of securities by $26 billion last month. European funds are also cutting holdings of Spanish and Italian assets and shortening their maturities of the investment they keep. So the ECB, in response to all of this, has undertaken to keep the European banks afloat and announced on the 7th of October that it will reintroduce 12 and 13-month duration loans, giving banks access to unlimited cash until January 2013. It will also spend 40 billion euros on covered bonds from next month and continue to lend banks as much money as they need at its regular financing operations, at least until July next year. So if you look at this, the ECB has really become the lender of last resort to countries, and it's propping up the entire European banking system. So you've got, in our view, a very, very dangerous situation. If you do not solve the sovereign debt issue, you're going to, and you can't do that if the transmission is likely to be through the banking sector and through trade. And therefore, what does that mean for South Africa? South Africa is experiencing exogenous price pressures on inflation, a slower domestic demand, slower revisions, downward revisions to growth, and a lot of this relates to your what's happening in the world. If you take it, and South Africa has made some very interesting strides and important strides in its diversification. If you looked at it a few years ago, South Africa's manufacturing exports, 40% would be going into Europe, 40-plus percent would be going into Europe. That's now down at 31%, but you've seen the rise in exports into the African continent. So 31% of our manufactured exports also go into the African continent. So you're seeing this shift, and that is a very important question for South Africa, is our role in the continent, what we can do, and how we can grow with the continent. The expectation of the continent as a whole, and obviously it varies country to country, but the expectation of growth for the African continent is 5.5% for this year and growing next year. Up to 6% is the expectation. Some countries around us are growing even more than that. Angola, Mozambique, obviously off different bases, but growing. Angola, Mozambique, Zambia in particular growing 7% and above, Ghana growing at about 11 or 12%. So you're seeing a very different scenario in the region and on the continent, which is very important about the options that we have, that we can exercise. What is the South African outlook? We're seeing household consumption expenditure slowing. We're seeing a very slow increase in private sector growth capital, fixed capital formation, both from government and from the private sector. In total, it's about 18.9%. You need it to be about 24-25%. We're seeing business and consumer confidence is below the 50 levels. That is quite negative. Our own forecasts are downward in terms of growth outlook. And we're also seeing inflation rising, so very similar to what's happening with other emerging markets. And the main channels, as I said, would be the trade and financial markets that would be that we would be impacted on by what's happening in Europe. So in that sense, I think that we, South Africa, really does have to look at our own ability to pull ourselves together as a country. There are big opportunities. People are looking for safe havens. We're seeing, at this point in time, capital outflows among emerging markets. All emerging markets are very similar with the numbers about what they're experiencing on outflows. And it's because of the... What you're seeing is that doesn't matter how much they downgrade the dollar, there's no substitute for the dollar. So even though it's been downgraded and you're having real difficulties in the United States around their debt ceiling and the ability to exercise policy and use the fiscal side of the balance sheet of the country, that's not taking place. It's very tough. So the primary role is being led by the central bank, the Federal Reserve. And similar in Europe, because you have a lot of countries, they're busy now passing the agreement to fund, but you're having weak coalition governments in many countries and a lot of indecision. And hence, coming back to Jean-Paul Trichet's statement, you need decisive action and you need it urgently to deal with this. You cannot prevaricate. The challenge for emerging markets is that as soon as there's uncertainty around what is happening in Europe, the investments flow out. And it goes back to the dollar. You've seen it with gold and you've seen it with the dollar. The reality is we don't know. I mean, a lot of countries are reacting to that. Our own view is that let us see how much this is being driven by this uncertainty, because the flight to familiarity, I would prefer to call it flight to familiarity than to safety, because I wouldn't necessarily say the dollar is your best bet, but they're totally familiar with the dollar, and it is the major currency. I think the question around that is the reasons why the emerging markets were receiving the kind of capital inflows that they have been receiving over this period have not gone away. The pension funds still have to pay pensioners. They still have to meet those obligations. So, you know, we need to look at it in terms of the current uncertainty and the fact that there is very little resolution to the challenges that are being faced, as well as then what is the demand in the longer term. And therefore a very unpredictable, uncertain, and very difficult time ahead for a long period of time. I think we cannot underestimate that globally you are in a situation of high unemployment. I just want to see if I've got a number here. That's Mohamed El Arian from PIMCO was talking about U.S. unemployment. And he was saying that... he said that the official unemployment rate in the U.S. stands at 9%, which is 9.1, which is what they're saying. And if you look at the job numbers that come out, everybody hangs on to them. And if they're up, that's great. But he says that almost 20% of the population is either unemployed or underemployed in the United States. So those are numbers. If you look at other countries, if you look at Spain, Spain's unemployment numbers are very similar to ours. Generally speaking, the unemployment is about 21%. Youth unemployment is about 45%. And you're seeing this growing in many countries. And therefore, a really, in my view, a very, very difficult and dangerous global environment in which South Africa has to function and look at the opportunities, because I think there are, for us to look at ourselves in our region, domestically, and ensure that we all have a common understanding of the challenges and what we need to do, because this needs a country response to enable us to weather the storm. Our banking sector has not had the same problems at all. Perhaps very briefly, I hope that has covered some of the issues. I don't know if my colleagues would like to add.
Honourable Chair, it's shocking, and you know, you start having goose flesh when the governor gives us this information. I don't have a question, but just to thank you. We read about these things on the paper, then we say sometimes there's some hyperbolism. Then you keep on asking yourself, if it is that big, why then France and Germany, they meet and table the plan they're talking about, either than, you know, playing hide and seek. But, yeah, thank you. It's frightening. It's really, really frightening. Thanks.
I can only agree with you. And part of it, I mean, if I could just perhaps add in some way, you know, as South Africa, we are in a very interesting and challenging position. Because in many of the meetings, we're the only country from the African continent. I'm talking about the global meetings. So that our voice and our coherence and what we see is extremely important. So whether we're going to the G20, we leave for the G20 tomorrow. The G20 meeting is on Friday and Saturday, where all of these things get discussed again. And our challenge is, because we're the only country from the continent, is how do we speak for those whose voices are not there? And I'm not talking about a mandate. I'm talking about the issues, because obviously this isn't a mandated position by any country. But to go there and say, what is happening? Because when you are dealing with these issues, if we don't get resolution, how does that affect countries like ourselves? And then not to create a false expectation, because the heart of the issue right now is confidence and trust. If you look at it, we take Merkel and Sarkozy have met and said we're going to do this. So everybody says, okay, when, what, how? And they've got huge dynamics. Don't forget, France is coming for an election. Merkel is in a situation with a coalition government. So there's a lot of domestic pressures, which they're also having to address. But you can't do it through creating a situation that we're kicking the can down the road all the time, which is what has been happening. So the problem has actually become huge. because before when you start, this isn't about Greece anymore. This is long past Greece and whether it will default or not. And if you looked at it, it went from Greece, Spain, I mean Portugal, Ireland, as the peripheral. Spain's not so peripheral, it's rather a large country. But it even jumped Spain and went to Italy. So the challenge now on the cards is what's happening to Italy. And Italy is the third biggest bond market in the world. So part of the answers that you have is how do you deal with these issues in a coherent way? And therefore, as the South African approach is in all the forums that we participate in, whether it's G20, BIS, Basel Committee for Banking Supervision, the payment system, we're in a whole lot of the working groups around it, is to raise our concerns about taking decisions and seeing them through and making sure that these things can be dealt with and acting to say this is part of the challenge that we have and the role that South Africa has in ensuring that among, and we're not alone, let's be very clear, we're not alone, that when we go there may be others not from the continent but who have very similar views to what we do about the challenges that we face and the indecision creating a lot of the difficulties.
Okay, thank you, Governor. I think we have come to an end of your presentation. Thank you very much for the valuable information that you have provided to this committee, the clarities that you have provided in relation to the report and the other general or current issues that the committee was interested on. I think, Governor, I will forward this to the chairperson of this committee, that we need more or frequent engagements with the Reserve Bank outside the standard meetings that we normally have as directed by the rules of the institutions. I think we need to have open discussions on some of these issues that you were raising. The current financial instability, how does it affect South Africa? Our program or agenda to build a better Africa, how do we position South Africa in that global agenda and also respond to the expectations of the world and of the region in particular. So I think at some point we'll have to meet with the Reserve Bank so that we can engage on these matters, maybe outside the eye of the media, so that we can free to raise some of the sensitive issues that we need to engage on. I would suggest that...
Madam Chair, we're more than happy to engage with you as often as you would like. And obviously we can take different times so that, you know, we can, if we work together on the timing of it, we can look at it, say, when you've had the IMF G20 meetings to come back and give information on that. And we're also very happy to host you at the bank.
Okay.
So that, you know, in a sense, if members want to be familiar with more detail on particular areas, then they can engage with those departments or, and we can set up a program for you, as we did last year, to say come for a day or two at the bank and we can take you around the issues and so on.
Thank
so
you
we'd
very
be very
much.
Happy to do that. All we would ask is, given the diaries, if we can get notice about it so that it is doable. You know, we wouldn't like to have to say we can't make that date. But between myself and the deputies, certainly, and the teams involved, we would welcome that.
Thank you very much, Governor. We will do
and thank you for the opportunity
to
engage with you today.
Thank you. The meeting is adjourned until tomorrow. Honorable members, if you can remain for 2 minutes, so that we prepare for tomorrow.